This is the Hugo Award winning SFSignal.com podcast. I'm your host. My name is Patrick Hester. And today I have a very special episode for you. We're going to call it a triptych because it is actually three podcasts in one. So you have the Once in Future podcast with Anton Strout. You have the Speculate podcast with Gregory Wilson and Brad Beaulieu. And then you have, of course, the SF Signal podcast. We got together and we recorded this. And this is the results of that little experiment. And I hope you like it. There was one thing that happened. They did ask me a question of how the SF Signal podcast got started. And we ended up not actually answering that question because I asked them to talk about their podcast instead. If you've never heard that story, I will tell it very, very quickly. Essentially, I had a podcast on my website called All Things From My Brain. And John Anilio had a podcast on his website, which was the Sci-Fi Songs blog. And DiNardo had made an introduction between the two of us. And I was thinking at the time I would like to have a second voice on my podcast. And apparently Anilio was thinking the same thing about his. And we kind of got together and said, well, let's do a podcast together. And at the time I suggested we host it through SF Signal. We tried to get DiNardo to do it. But we weren't necessarily confident that SF Signal, being as big as it is, would want us. So we went out and started the Functional Nerds first as kind of a proof of concept. We wanted to prove that we could do a podcast every week. And we did that. We got the Functional Nerds up and running. And then when we decided to go to DiNardo and SF Signal, we realized that we kind of didn't want to take Functional Nerds over there because it already had kind of an established brand now and a little bit more freedom. We could talk about things outside of science fiction and fantasy. So we ended up just going to John and saying, hey, you know, we'd love to do an SF Signal podcast. Anilio was part of that for the first couple, and then he bailed because it was just too much of a time commitment for him, which I completely understand. And I have been there ever since, just, you know, doing podcasting every week for SF Signal, and folks seem to appreciate it and enjoy it. So as long as they do, I'll still be here. Anyway, the Triptych podcast, this is what we're calling it, or we're also calling it the Voltron podcast. The lions, not the ships. And it was a good time. It was a good time. So take a listen, and hopefully you guys enjoyed as much as I enjoyed being a part of it.
All right, so we are closing in on the end of our fourth year of production in Speculate as a fantasy and science fiction podcast. And with all of the authors and editors and artists we've interviewed, we have never, Brad, actually spoken to podcasters in this medium other than each other. And that changes tonight with a first for us, actually, with not one but two distinguished guests. And the podcast that everyone out there is listening to is going to be actually – I was about to say simulcast, but this is recorded, so that doesn't quite make sense. But you follow what I mean. It will be used in three different venues, if you will, and three different podcasts will be playing this episode as we have a roundtable discussion with two colleagues of ours from the industry. The first is an author and a blogger and a two-time Hugo winner and a multiple nominee too, I believe, for his work on the SF Signal website and podcast. He also reviews graphic novels for Kirkus, and I've had a chance to talk to him before at Worldcon, and we are very happy to welcome Patrick Hester to the show. So Patrick, hi, welcome.
Hi, thanks guys. Yes, yes, this will end up on sfsignal.com as part of the SF Signal podcast. And we are Hugo Award winning, which I have to mention that so that John DiNardo gives me my cookie. And the blog won for best fanzine, and the podcast did win for best fan cast. And really, I owe that all to the Squeecast for, you know, bowing out. But other than that, yeah, all the stuff that you talk about, I write, I podcast, and I have the blog over at Kirkus as well. The other person that is part of this little I haven't heard of anybody else doing this before, so I'm not even sure what to call this. I think you're right.
Territory.
It's a like, tricast. It's,
yeah, can we call it a revolution?
A tricast. I like that. A tricast. It takes me back to Legend of Zelda.
Ah, nice.
But that extra voice is going to be Anton Strout.
Hello there. I do the Once and Future podcast here. I also write the Simon Candris Urban Fantasy series, as well as the Spellmason Chronicles. And I somehow managed to do that around a day job at Penguin Random House, which is not as nepotistic as it seems, since they also happen to publish me, I promise you.
You're, and Anton, by the way, is also a former Gen Con author guest of honor, and he just interviewed Jim Butcher, and Brad and I are constrained to point out, Anton, that we got him first. So that's, you know.
Just, when did you get him? Because I've also had him.
God damn it. Well, I don't know. So we had him like, like a
can
month ago.
Can we pretend it was 3 years ago?
Yeah, it was a month ago.
So if it was a month ago, then I had him first.
Ah, see. Well, yes. You know, of course. Well, that's why you guys have your Hugos. That's why you have your Hugos. We're up next, Patrick. You know, like we're working on it. You know,
and Butcher is a great interview. He's a great guy. He's so much fun, and he's got so many pop culture references that they don't even all end up in the books.
It's true, and since all of us have the connection of also being interested in the game stuff as well, we actually first ran into Jim a little bit at Gen Con, and we ended up then interviewing after the fact. But Jim is a gamer, you know, mm-hmm. And I mean it's enjoyable to talk to someone who's that sort of invested in the other thing that I sort of enjoy as a hobby. You know, writing is not a hobby for me, but that is, and it's something that I enjoy doing, and so it's cool that he's that into it. And he was telling us, did he tell you the thing about how he plays? I forget what MMO he plays, but he actually put his name in as I think it was Harry Dresden, and they kept deleting his name and saying he couldn't do it because it's copyrighted. Right. And he's like, it's my guy. Like, it's really funny.
I really do have the rights to
it. I do have it. Yeah.
I'm going to be calling this the Voltron podcast.
Wait, whoa. Ships or tigers?
Oh, tigers.
Tigers. Oh, God. Okay. Yeah.
Come on.
Please.
Come on. If you're going ships, I'm just going to get out of the conversation.
No. Tigers all the way.
Yeah.
But if I want to be like, I want to be the head or the chest, but without the legs of Brad and Greg, who are still just nameless voices out there in the ether, you guys should probably introduce yourselves to form the full lion robot.
Yeah. So we can form Blazing Sword.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so we are, my name is Greg. I'll let Brett introduce himself in a minute. We run Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans. And, we have been doing this for, as I mentioned, we're in our fourth year, actually closing in on the end of our fourth year of production and, interviews and, all that sort of thing. And for myself, I am also, an author with, novels, in several places, short stories in several places, and a graphic novel coming out in a couple of months, and a college professor who teaches this stuff as well. So
Are you going to send me the graphic novel?
Yeah, in fact, I am absolutely going to do that. And that's one of the things we chatted about at WorldCon. By the way, Patrick may not remember this, but we actually met none other than Hugh Howie, who came up and talked. Do you remember that? That he actually came up and talked to us while we were chatting at WorldCon, I want to say in San Antonio, I believe. And he came up to us in the bar while we were chatting. And at that conversation is where you had mentioned that if I had a graphic novel, you'd love to review it. And I was like, yes, mm-hmm. please. So absolutely. And then, of course, my partner in crime, Brad.
I'm Brad Bollier, the other half of Speculate. And I'm also the author of The Lace of Onoskaya, which came out from Nightshade Books. And The Song of the Shattered Sands is a new series that sold to Daw Books and Glance in the UK. And also to Germany. I'm really excited about that a few weeks ago. That'll be coming out September next year.
Nice.
Every single day, every single day at about 11:58 p.m., I get an email from Nightshade where the subject is breaking news.
I know.
It's true.
I keep thinking about emailing them and saying, just stop. Just make something else.
Right.
Aren't they the broken news, really?
Oh, wow. Shots fired.
No.
Oh man, no chance of getting Skyhorse on board anytime soon as a sponsor.
I'm confused. So what's that word that you just used?
Wait,
Skyhorse?
Oh, Skyhorse?
No, you said sponsor.
A sponsor.
Oh, yeah. Well, only Anton knows about it. I mean, Anton literally told us that he's had to, I quote, delay his sponsors and they were getting frustrated. Like only Anton has, you know, this large group of people that he must serve, you know, on a regular basis so they can give him all the money and the bling.
Look, so 18 months ago, something tragic happened in my life. My twins were born, and the idea of, well, I love doing the podcast and I love doing it for free or a donation model. The idea of monetizing it so that it's kind of helping feed the kids at the same time, all shame kind of went away. So the idea of treating it like the big boy podcast, like Nerdist or anything on Leo Laporte's network,
right,
or Twit, I'm at least going to try the model, and it seems to be working, which should give all of us hope, really.
That's true.
Actually, what gives me hope is Tom Merritt.
Yeah, my goodness. Did you see that he was sort of like, thanks for hitting some absurd number, like 17,000 a month on his Patreon or something crazy.
It's even more than that, if I'm not mistaken. It's insane.
It's really nuts. Yeah, Tom's been on the show too, and it's funny because Tom is about that stuff just doesn't come through, where he's just like, yeah, so I'm doing this thing, and then this thing is this thing, you know what I mean? It's this major thing. But I mean, we've been running, our Patreon for similar reasons, you know, Anton. So, you know, we are with you. Actually, is FF Signal ever thought about doing something sort of now that you guys have won all your Hugos? So, you know, now that all the bling is sitting on the shelf, are you guys thinking about building up into are you going to be on NPR? You know, like what's the next, you know?
It's funny that you mentioned that. DiNardo and I chat often. And there's always been stuff that he's wanted to do. There's been stuff that I've wanted to do. Really, it comes down a lot to time and effort and the kind of bandwidth that we have. We like Anton was saying, you know, there's life tends to interrupt. Mm-hmm. And there's always other stuff going on. And, we haven't really discussed a Patreon. I'm not sure that our model works with paid. Does that make sense? You know, we've kind of done a little bit. There's another person involved with SF Signal named JP France, and JP handles like all the advertising on the website. Mm-hmm. And there's very little, you know, it's essentially Google ads most of the time. And as you know, most people don't pay any attention to ads anymore on websites. They have ad blockers. They have all this kind of stuff on there. It's there. I think it makes enough to pay the hosting. Really is about it. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people ask me all the time whenever I go to a convention and WorldCon, Mile High Con, you name it, I'm going to be one of the media guests of honor at Capricorn. I'm almost always put on the podcast panel where people sit in the audience and go, how do I make money as a podcaster?
yep.
And I throw out all these ideas for them. You know, I say, you can do Google ads, you can do Amazon Associates, you can do all these great things that will bring in easily 5 or 6 pennies a month.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
after tax too.
Yeah, after taxes. So to answer your question, we've talked about it. We just haven't ever done any of it because I think actually trying to execute it would take more energy than we have at this point. Anelio and I on the Functional Nerds have talked about doing a Patreon or Patreon. I don't know even how to pronounce
Patreon?
It.
Patreon.
Something like that. Yeah. And our hesitation with that and with Kickstarter is that we don't want to go to that well all the time. Mm-hmm. And so when we go to that well, we want to make sure that whatever we can provide to the people who are willing to give us some money is really, really worth it to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we keep going, well, we could do this and this and this. But, you know, if we don't have it all in place, we don't have something decent to provide to people who are willing to support us, then we don't want to do it.
Yeah, we had to chat quite a bit about that with we had a talk with Howard Taylor, actually, and we were talking mm-hmm. to him a little bit about writing excuses and what and his theories about what stuff worked and what stuff didn't and all that. And yeah, I think it's true that one of the things that we got from him was being able to still provide the basics of what we had done for the show, because the other problem we had is that we were running the show for just about, you know, close to 3.5 years, I'd say, without, you know, for free. And so at a certain point, we can't just shift overnight and be like, you know, now you will pay us for everything. You know, can't do that. So we had to provide a lot of the show, but still
sure.
sort of separate a couple of things, which is why we started doing the thing where we put the Writing Technique show basically mm-hmm. behind a paywall, and not a high paywall, like $3 a month paywall, which is not, I think, for something which is coming out on a regular basis 4 times a month, usually 3 to 4 times a month, that's not that bad. But yeah, figuring out what was going to be enough added content. And we're still working. I mean, the Patreon is only a few months old, so we're still tweaking it and everything. But I think that was really important, was to figure out how much we could provide and how much we couldn't, you know.
Well, you're listening to Ad Talk here on
NPR. I know.
Incredibly
exciting.
You know, I've thought about taking our formats to radio stations and NPR and places like that, and seeing if, you know, they wanted to have something or do something with us. And I can't see it happening, to be honest with you. As far as sponsors go, I've gone out before and tried to find sponsors. Borderlands in San Francisco was really cool to us. And they said, hey, you know, we want to give it a shot. And I came to them with this plan. I said, okay, we're going to do a bunch of spots for you on our episodes. And, you know, tell me what books are coming out. Tell me who's coming to do signings, and we'll do a spot every week for that. And what ended up happening was they sent me one spot that I had to play over and over and over for 3 months or something. And so when you do two episodes a week, that becomes really kind of monotonous. And what happened was I had a little bit of listener backlash because they were tired of listening to that ad over and over and over again.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So that which shows you the importance to the sponsors out there of diversity in advertising.
Absolutely.
You know, that's really important. So I guess that's actually a good way to sort of ask how each of us got into podcasting in the first place. Like, Anton, why did you, you know, after your incredibly successful career as on the writing side already in the Penguin side, clearly with your vast media empire, there was no real need for you to get involved in this. So it must have been a labor of love, I assume, right?
I just wanted less writing time, really.
Okay, good.
That's what I really wanted to do, was suck every last bit of time I could be committing words to the page out of my life.
Right.
I'm friends with Chris Hardwick, who a lot of people will know as the Nerdist, and his empire that has risen up over the past couple of years. And he had – Penguin's NAL group had bought his book, The Nerdist Way, so he was coming into the office. And I had been a fan of his for a while. So we kind of became friends when he popped into the office, and I had to translate geek speak to a lot of my contemporaries who are book people but not necessarily hardcore nerds. And his whole idea, and I saw him in conversation with Guillermo del Toro talking about creativity and controlling stuff and not answering to too many masters. And it was just a very inspirational time and talk. And I really need, like, the writing's in my control as far as I control what's on the page, but there's editors, there's copy editors, there's a lot of other taskmasters in there who have some kind of say. And I just wanted a forum with which I could talk to authors. I'm already having these conversations in the bars at Gen Con with you guys and stuff like that, and I find them interesting. I was like, this is something I can control. It can be my own. And let's see if people want to hear these conversations be shared about writing and everything else. So I just kind of jumped in and threw Charlaine Harris on my first episode and just went crazy for 2 years straight before I took a break to have the babies and all. Well, not me have the babies, but, you know.
To clap and applaud as the babies were had.
Well
yes.
Done.
I know the feeling.
Stand quietly in the corner as I'm supposed to in the delivery room.
Yeah, exactly. So, Patrick, how'd you get involved?
Well, before you get to me, I want to hear how Brad and Greg got involved.
Oh.
Because Brad has hardly said anything. He's like a Chinese gold farmer in World of Warcraft.
That's actually what he's doing as we speak.
I've got 15,000 so far. Yeah, well, you know, Greg and I started it after a conversation that we had at World Fantasy, I want to say 2010?
10, Columbus.
Yeah, I think it was. And it was, you know, it was after a conversation that we had at dinner about Kish Johnson's Spar. And we started talking about, you know, we had different takes on what worked for us, what didn't work. And Greg hadn't brought up anything about podcasting at that point, but, you know, like, what was it, 2-3 weeks later, he pinged me and asked, would you like to be on one? And I had never done anything like podcasting before. I'd done some public speaking for work, but nothing like this. And, you know, so I didn't have a lot of experience, but it seemed like something good to do, largely, frankly, to keep me in reading. Because like Anton says, there's so little time. And I actually found myself perhaps writing too much, like maybe being in too much of a box and not getting outside of that enough. Mm-hmm. You know, and so I would read a bit, but I was probably down to, I don't know, 6 to 10 books a year.
Mm-hmm. Poor you writing too much. Boo.
Yeah, I know. You know, but like, I'm getting into like, what do I get out of it kind of thing. But one of the things that you'll hear in, you know, writing is to get better, you read, but not just read, you have to read critically. And that's been one of the coolest things about having the podcast is being able to really dig. Cause I would read books, but I wouldn't necessarily really try to diagnose them too much. But this, you know, kind of forces us to, cause we dig a lot into the fiction that we read and the three shows that we do, the triptych model. And why don't you touch on that, Greg, our triptych? model.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that was actually Brad's idea. I had done
in self-defense, I will admit, because I'm a slow reader.
That's why. no, we had. Yeah, it's that's pretty much the case. We had chatted about doing it before. Something I had thought about doing something like that before. I should say I had actually done a couple of podcasts before this. One which was a comedy show, and one which was like a review show, sort of a generalized review show. Back in 2005, sort of like the heady days of podcasting when Adam Curry was calling it a podcast and all that stuff. And so I had wanted to do something like that, and more or less it was similar reasons to Brad, except for I also wanted to be able to have a chance to have a context within which I could speak to some of these people. I mean, there was a little bit of it that was sort of like it networking. I mean, I'll admit that. There was a little bit that was like I'd like to meet these people and have a context to do it. But there was also the fact that I wanted to be able to – because I've always absorbed – a lot of information from people that I meet and find myself improving significantly as a writer as I gain this information from people. So, you know, for me, a lot of these things that we've done have been like a series of master classes, you know, with Michael Swanwick and James Patrick Kelly and Robin Hobb and Kiz Johnson and N.K. Jemisin and just like on and on and on, and Brandon Sanderson and Pat Rothfuss and all these people. And you're just like, you know, it just hopefully osmotically, I'm kind of absorbing some of that. But it's really important to me, especially as someone who teaches it also, to just be able to kind of take it all in. And that's one of the big reasons why I love doing the show, because we've really gotten to learn a lot. And I can't really think of any guest that we've had that we didn't learn something from, honestly. And so the triptych model was designed to sort of take advantage of that, because Brad's theory was, rather than just, you know, bringing in people for interview after interview or having a sort of unrooted show that didn't talk about anything specifically, what if we had a model where we had a reader response show where we both, you know, sort of react to a book as readers, then an interview with the given author, have that be one of the shows. And then the last show would be a writing technique show where we use our experience as authors to actually talk about several aspects of that book and ways that people, both readers, could get more appreciation of the craft and also writers could learn something about it as well. So that's totally Brad. It was, and I think it was unique to us, and I think it was a really great idea that Brad came up with. The whole, like, I didn't know this was him being a slow reader, but I mean, I just thought it was genius move on his part, I assumed. So that was where I got it from. But yeah, so it's been great for that reason.
Very cool.
Podcasting to me is informative to me as it is to my listeners. At least I hope so anyway. I'm curious, what's the most profound things that your guests have said that you really took away to your own work? For me, it was Jim Butcher, my last episode. Now, he has chapter-by-chapter beta readers. So I guess step one in the process is, one, write a 23-book best-selling series and have a legion group of fans that you can then bump your work to become your chapter-by-chapter beta readers. Yep. But it kind of makes sense. I'd never given my work chapter-to-chapter to be vetted, and it kind of, especially given my process, I think it would actually work out well for me because I tend to fix it all in the end, and maybe if I fixed it a little more as I went, it would be helpful. Also, Butcher says he stays in one project at a time. He doesn't do Codex Alera and Dresden Files at the same time. He drills down and only concentrates on one, and I've been trying to, as I'm pitching a couple new ideas, write several things at once, and I need to just stop that maybe a little bit and drill down into one of them. So those were kind of my big takeaways recently. I'm curious what you guys, some of the more memorable things that you've taken away for your processes.
So the one that stands out is Brent Weeks. We interviewed him twice, but it was the first one where we interviewed him, where he said, we were talking about backstory a bit, and I don't remember why we got on the subject, but he mentioned George Martin and how good he is at bringing up backstory only when it, not just when it's important, but when it actually has an effect on like the current story. And that was like a huge light bulb for me, because you hear like, the common refrain will be, make the reader want to know about the backstory first, you know, and typically that might be something like, you know, make something in the present, make them curious about the past in some way. But this was like one step further. It was like bringing up backstories in some way that it actually does affect how things are going on today, like, you know, a reveal of some kind. And So I thought that was really a neat way to look at it, and I've tried to pull that into my writing.
That's interesting. I think probably the one for me, and it's something I don't know that it was as much affected my process as it was sort of something I was now that I'm conscious that I do more of or that I'm willing to do more of, and it has to do with my sort of opinions towards my characters. When we were interviewing Lauren Bugis, actually, who we spoke a little bit about before we came on air, we were talking to her about The Shining Girls, and she was expressing how in the process of writing her book, one of the things she was trying to do was seek out justice in a way that was not available in real life. She had seen the way that the justice system had failed people in South Africa, and how she had wanted to write something in which it was possible that justice could be achieved. And moreover, that the character, one of the bad guy, the villain in that book, was someone that she genuinely, personally, and even viscerally despised. Which to me was very unusual, because my sense always when I speak to a lot of authors is that they sort of have this very extremely nuanced approach. You know, no one wants to admit that they come in trying to make a villain a villain. They're like, well, it's multiple shades of gray and you can't really, everyone could be their villain hero of their own story and blah, 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 blah. And of course that's certainly remains true. You don't want to create sort of stereotypical characters, but it hadn't occurred to me how much she how much an author could be genuinely invested emotionally in the writing of his or her story, and how that does not necessarily disrupt the writing process. And for me, as someone who came from an academic background and had a tendency to, I think, sometimes over-intellectualize my writing and try to be sort of not cold or clinical, but very nuanced and very sort of detailed and clear. And some of the things that were getting sucked out of my early writing, quite honestly, was sort of the emotional content. And when I started giving myself permission to let myself feel about what I was writing and not just to be sort of separate as if I was this artisan who was kind of writing from a distance, I don't write from a distance anymore. And I think it's improved my writing 100-fold, because I think now it hits people in the gut more, because it hits me in the gut more. Stories that I've written about, like The Caretaker of Myers, a short story of mine that Brad's heard, which was written very much with my daughter in mind. I was thinking about my daughter as I wrote it. And I think that's one of the best things I've written, because I really sort of allowed myself to become emotionally invested in it. And a lot of that came from what she said. It really shocked me, frankly, that an author, you know, with that much success was willing to say how much she viscerally disliked or, you know, viscerally rooted for her own characters. And that was a big thing for me.
Interesting. There's so much that I want to say. I recently had a listener who left a comment that was somewhere along the lines of, it took me a while to get Patrick's sense of humor, but once I did, now I'm on board. So longtime listeners of SF Signal will know that my sense of humor is an acquired taste, and it's a blend of Joss Whedon and Monty Python.
Are you talking about on the show or in your writing?
So everywhere, yes.
Okay.
So there was a moment, all of my cousins are much older than I am. My brother, for example, is 13 years older than I am.
Okay.
So all the sisters were having kids, and then 13 years later, my mom decided to have me. Anyway, I have a cousin who is about 8 years older than I am. She's like a big sister. And I remember very clearly when she took me out and said, look, you have to stop wearing blue jeans and t-shirts. And she took me to, I believe it was Mervyn's, and said, this is what adults wear, khakis and polo shirts. And she actually spent some money and she bought me all these clothes. She says, you're an adult now. You need to act like one. You need to dress like one. And I kind of took that to heart. And I'd been writing since high school. And everything I was writing was very, very kind of serious. I was trying to be this serious author, and I wanted to be taken seriously. You know, I wanted to have literary awards and all this other kind of, you know, crap. And what I've learned from the podcast and from my interactions with all these authors, one of my favorites is Gail Carriger. And what I've learned from Gail is that you can have a sense of humor and you can put it in your writing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it can even be over the top slapstick. And you talked about Brent Weeks. What I've learned from Brent Weeks, I was freaking out on Twitter one day. I mean, just absolutely freaking out, because I don't outline. I am as Merle Lafferty
says, ultimate pantser.
I'm a pantser. Yes, I'm a discovery writer, as Merle Lafferty would say. And when I start writing, I let the characters take me where they're going. So I wrote this urban fantasy, and everybody loved this urban fantasy. And then I threw it out, and I started over, and I rewrote the urban fantasy. And then I met Gail Carriger, and I started reading her books, and I went, whoa, there's all this humor in here. This is really cool. But, I can't obviously do that in my writing. And then I read Jim Butcher, and I went, holy, I don't know your guys' podcast, but on mine, there's no restrictions on cussing, but just in case there is, I won't cuss. I'll say, holy crap. You know, look at all this humor in here. This is wonderful. This is me. This is my sense of humor. And so then I took my urban fantasy and I threw it out again and I rewrote it and I put in all the comedy and the humor that I wanted to have in it originally, but that I didn't put in it because I wanted people to take me seriously. And so I rewrote it and I took it to a critique group, and I sat down and I went to this critique group month after month, because you had to go several months in a row before you could submit. You had to critique, you had to read other people's stuff. And I did that, and I submitted my stuff, and I had to wait a month. And I remember it was the worst month of my life, because this was the first time I had let, you know, other authors read my book. And I'd just given them 50 pages, but still I was freaking out. And I gave it to them and I sat down and they go, what draft is this? And I said, I don't know, third or fourth or something like that. And they said, well, it's very clean. It's very good. You know, I love the sense of humor. One guy said, I was sitting at Village Inn reading this, and I apologize for the coffee stains because I spit coffee out of my nose as I was reading this. And I thought that was the highest compliment I could get.
Yeah.
Anyway, I had this great urban fantasy. I had a agent who was interested in repping me, and based on this urban fantasy, and he says, do you have ideas for book two? And I said, yes, I've got ideas for book two and book three. He said, great, send me the outlines. I'm freaking out on Twitter. I don't have outlines. And Brent Weeks sends me a direct message. He says, it doesn't matter. And I said, what do you mean it doesn't matter? He says, it doesn't matter. Write whatever you want. Just write a paragraph. They don't care. I said, they don't care? He's like, no. No one will ever hold you to that outline. Just write the paragraph, send it to him, and see what he says. And that's what I did. And the agent was like, great, perfect, let's go.
And then you were like, by the way, Brent Weeks told me to tell you this is a lie, right? Like,
right. That's okay. Yeah. And then I wrote the second book. And I sent it to him, and it was completely different. He's like, didn't care.
I've turned in summaries of the book, just like a brief one page, and the first paragraph or two is kind of tight, but by the end of it, it's like, and then things happen, and an awesome fight is happening here, and it's going to be so kick-ass, you won't believe it. And they've probably stopped reading by then anyway. No one's ever called me on it. No one's ever been like, where's that kick-ass fight I was promised right here?
The other big thing that I've taken away from the guests that I've had on and the people that I've talked to is that if you're looking for a good story to write, all you have to do is become friends with shaman in the Amazon and let them give you drugs, and then the drugs will make you high, and then you'll be able to write a story.
I got to listen to way more of the podcast than I do, obviously, because I wasn't aware that was the niche you were appealing to.
It was one of the very first interviews I ever did. It's the guy who did all of the alien stuff. He did Fingerprints of the Gods and all this kind of stuff. And I this was when it was very green, and I hadn't done very many interviews, and I was taking anything that publicists were sending me, and I was just doing interviews with people. And this guy came on, and I remember I had to call him in New York. He was in a hotel. And I'm sitting there, and I said, so where did it's the standard interviewer question. Where did the idea for this story come from, right? And you figure they're going to say, oh, well, you know, I just had this idea, and the idea took hold, and it grew, and I did this, and I started developing the characters in the world. No, he didn't say that. He's like, well, you know, I've been to the Amazon so many times that the shaman in this one tribe really likes me. And so one of the times I was down there, and he gave me drugs. And while I was tripping, the universe shared this story with me. So I started writing it down.
Don't do drugs, kids.
Right, that's the takeaway point. You know, it's funny though, just to bring in something just for a moment about the how you end up learning, and I think this probably has to do, and I should know this already because I see it in my students, there's a certain pattern to the lessons that the universe gives you. And I think it has to do with your receptivity to those lessons, right? So I don't know if you guys had this experience, but for me, I mentioned the emotional content thing. I got that originally from Lauren Bucus, but I've actually had it sort of reified with other interviews that we've done with people, even interviews that were not related to books specifically. I did an interview I run a Twitch channel. So I did an interview of the guys who did Ubisoft Montpellier that did Valiant Hearts, The Great War, which is a game about World War One, and is an extraordinary game, really, with a very powerful sort of emotional component. And these guys, the guy who I was doing the interview with, was talking about going to – they're all French. And he was talking about going to his great-grandmother and her showing him tintypes of, you know, her husband who had been in World War One or other. And how for him, he said this is by far the most important project that he had ever done. And he said we couldn't get it wrong. He said we couldn't get it wrong because so much was riding on it. He's like – and I felt like I was speaking to him as I was doing the game. Just and again, I mentioned it because I think it was a lesson that I said, yes, emotional content. And I had already experienced that lesson previously, and I continued to experience it. And so I find like those patterns happen with author interviews we do as well, where there, you know, you'll get these answers, which are really wonderful. And you'll be like, that's not unlike what, you know, Tim Powers said, that he's always afraid they're going to find out about him this time. And he's written himself into a corner and he can't escape. And it's Tim Powers, but Tim Powers says that. And then you'll hear that same thing replicated from author after author after author. Is like, oh no, I'm fully convinced I'm going to fail this time. You know, like, I mean, they all say that, and I shouldn't say they all, but a number of them say that. So it's amazing how much of this follows rather clear, somewhat even predictable lines. And I don't know whether that's comforting or disturbing, but it's definitely the case that, you know, a lot of them are saying the same sorts of things, and you begin to pick up patterns as you interview lots of different people.
No, I think it's absolutely comforting. Yeah. And to be honest with you, that's why I started listening to I Should Be Writing, which is Merle Afferty's podcast. Mm-hmm. I would sit there as a writer and I'm going, I just belched out 1200 words in the last couple of days. And while I was writing them, they were the best words I'd ever created in my life. And now as I'm reading them on the weekend, I realize what utter and complete crap they are and what a loser I am. And no one's ever going to love these words.
Yep.
No one's ever going to want to publish these words. Oh, crap. What, you know, and then I'll turn on I Should Be Writing and there's Merle Afferty going, you know, I wrote a lot this week and as I was writing the words, they were just fantastic. And now that I'm reading them, they're crap. And no one's going to ever want to read them. And no one's ever going to. And I'm going, oh, it's not just me.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
not alone.
Yeah.
We all have those insecurities.
Yeah.
It's a great comfort. I mean, you know, I'll talk to a Charlaine Harris. I'll talk to a Pat Rothfuss. I'll talk to a Jim Butcher. And they will, their books debut as number one on the bestseller list. There's no question that they're going to move books, that they're going to sell books, that people love what they're writing. Yet, hands down, each and every one I talk to, from those authors down to my level of author, all of them have the same insecurities that they're about to be called a fraud, or that there's rampant insecurity even at the top of the list all the way through it. And while I'm busy sweating that as I'm trying to get words down, because my biggest block is, oh, what if I'm not good enough? I'm like, oh, they experience that and they're considered, you know, masters of their genre. I should probably calm down a little and just write.
Right.
Well, I won't name names, but there was an author who made it onto the New York Times bestselling list. And when they made it onto the list, they shared with me the fact that they received an email that said, you are now on the New York Times bestselling list. And they deleted it because they were freaked out thinking sent it to the wrong author.
Nice.
It can't possibly be me.
Yeah. Wow.
That's funny. Yeah, I just posted 2 days ago that I'm just finishing up the final edits for 12 Kings and Sharakai, which comes out next year. And this was after talking with Betsy Wolheim to get her final edits and such. And you know, and it, tons of beta readers, you know, three major drafts that I did on it. And I said, I have officially entered the this sucks portion of the novel, because I was just like so disgusted at everything that I was reading in the chapter at that point. And I've heard that from a lot of people too. You know, like Anton said, Pat Rothfuss, others, you get to this point where your eyes start to cross and you don't know, you know, what's what anymore.
Yeah. And it's fundamentally important, right, as authors to have a sort of critical sense and a critical eye, because although you cannot edit your own work and should not, you do have to have some self-editing before it goes out or the draft is going to be impossible, right? I mean, you have to be able to make adjustments and hopefully as you become more skilled, make more of those adjustments as time goes on. And so it's almost that's a really important skill to cultivate. The flip side of it, though, is that it's a skill that then is very hard to shut off, you know, so that you get to the point where you're like, but God, no. And everyone else at that point is like, what are you doing? Like, this is great. Like, what, you know, and you're still back in the stage of no, because I must. And there's no one left to convince at that point. You know, you've one of the things that was really important for me, and I'm trying to remember who it was that I learned. It might have. I wonder if this came from Brent Weeks, actually, also. But one of the things was talking about what readers expect. And the thing that was interesting to me was that readers are actually, despite sort of people saying, oh, readers are going to find any flaw in your work, readers are in general far more forgiving than you are. Much, much more forgiving. And the reason, if you think about it, is logical. No one goes into a work wanting it to suck. Right? No one goes to a theatrical performance hoping that the actor forgets his lines and makes a fool of himself because it's uncomfortable and awkward and because it's a waste of money that you spent on it, right? Everyone wants you to do well. So if you think of it that way, if everyone goes in with the best possible feelings about it, which is to say, I really want this book to be good, that is an incredible benefit, it seems to me, as writers, that we have a lot more buffer zone on their end than we may think, which is not to say that we should become complacent, but I don't think any of us are, you know, any author that I've talked to, complacency is not the issue. You know, the issue is this, you know, letting the self-critical voice take over until we, you know, shut down from sort of paralysis over, oh my God, this is too terrible. Well, and so I think that's really beneficial that the reader actually is more forgiving than we are.
Well, I'll throw it out there that I think that one of the things that all authors need to get good about is letting go.
Right, right.
And you have some fantastic authors out there who freak out over stuff. For example, you know, Peter Brett will not release a draft to his editor until he is absolutely 100% sure. He wants it to be the cleanest, best draft it can possibly be before that editor ever sees it. Mm-hmm. You also have people who like Chuck Wendig. Chuck Wendig's like, write it and then put it out there and see what happens. Don't obsess over it. Don't freak out over it. Sure, edit it, rewrite it if you need to. Do the normal stuff, but don't become OCD about it. Mm-hmm. Write it and then put it out there and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I unfortunately can't do that. I freak out over mine. You know, I want to say there's like a scale between Chuck and Peter, and I'm somewhere in the middle.
The Chuck Peter scale of Chuck Peter scale.
That will please both of them to no end.
Yes, yes.
I've done enough reading critique now that I see the people who don't write because they get so precious about every word and every paragraph right off the bat that yep. Then they have zero words down and nothing to fix. I can fix 100,000 crappy words. Hopefully they're not all crappy, but allowing yourself the permission to suck is kind of part of the game because it's called a first draft for a reason. It implies that there will be a second, third, tenth at some times.
Right.
I can fix something that's on the page. When it's blank, there's nothing to fix.
And it's often faster too, right? Because you've already got the work there. So, you know, it's to me anyway, psychologically, it's more, I know I'm like, well, I wrote it, you know, like there's a book here, like it needs to be fixed and cleaned up, but it exists. You know, I don't have to go, oh my God, I have 100,000 more words to go. You know, someone like Rob Ziegler, who wrote Seed, who's a mutual friend of Brad's and mine. I don't understand people like Rob because Rob is just like, yeah, so here's this beautiful thing. We did this one workshop with him and, there was this great, great manuscript that it was just really, I thought it was spectacular and gorgeous and genre altering and all that. He's like, so I talked to him about it. I think about a year later, he's like, yeah, it wasn't working for me. So I threw it out. I'm like, you did what? Can I have it? Like, what do you mean you threw it out? You know? And he was just like, yeah, I don't know. Some people can do that, but boy, no, I, God, no. I mean, and he just feels like he wants it, that first one to be really pristine. And I'm probably also somewhere between the Chuck Peter scale as well.
But yeah, years ago, one of the earliest conventions I went to when I was living out in Orange County, went to a convention, I think it was Lost Con, and Harry Turtledove was there, and he said that you write. Someone asked him how he knew when he was done, and he's like, you write until you're not making it, you're only making it different, not better.
Oh, I like
and that can be that helps me a lot actually, because I can really not like, I can be numb to what I've written because I've read it so many times, but I can pick up on whether or not I'm actually changing things for the better or not, or if it's just changing the words. And if that's the case, I know it's ready.
What I also love is there's no one true path. Part of doing the reading critiques at, say, Gen Con is you get a panel of four or five people who are kind of giving their feedback, and there's not necessarily one true way. There's a lot of paths to it. And I feel like you're going to hear a lot of differing opinions or critique of work, and there's going to be that one thing for that person there who it clicks with. And mm-hmm. I find I'm constantly pulling from a bag of tricks. I imagine a big medicine bag full of tricks of stuff I learned from Kidge, from Brad, from everyone else who I've kind of been in contact with or who I've heard talk about writing at different points. And that bag has no bottom, and that bag is constantly being filled with new tricks.
Yep, absolutely. And it also, it ends up feeding on itself in a nice way, because as I imagine you would agree, because I've done the reading critiques with you and so has Brad, of course, that the more you're critiquing someone else, evaluating someone else is enormously helpful, perhaps even more helpful than having your own work critiqued, right? I mean, that's an old saw, which I think is probably very true in many cases. Well, and largely it's because you're looking at the outside of things. No, not so much?
Well, there's good and there's bad critiques.
Well, yeah, I mean, this assumes good critiquing.
Right. I've been part of so many different critique groups since I moved to Denver, and essentially I went out and found critique groups because what we do as authors is we start off writing in our basement or in our little cubby or in Starbucks or wherever we're writing, and it's just us and there's no one else and there's no outside influence and there's no one else reading it. And then we give it to our mom, right? And our mom loves us. And our mom says, "Oh, this is so good. You should be published," you know, and you're
like, "Oh." That was not what my mom was doing, let me tell you.
Right. And so you have to go out and find other people who are going to be harsh and tell you that you suck. And that's when you kind of start building up that skin, right? As the author, because you have to be able to, it's not just about giving a critique. You have to be able to take a critique.
Sure.
And I can't tell you how many times I've seen people not be able to do either.
That's true. No, and it certainly is the quality of the critique is very important. That's definitely true.
I've seen people walk out of a room after a critique because they're just pissed. Yeah. And they can't believe that you didn't tell them what a fantastic whatever it was that you read.
Right.
You know, one thing that happens to me also is I sometimes I can't turn the critique off. I'll be reading published novels going, "Oh my God, where was the editor? Where was the editor? Why did this word get through? Come on.
Yeah, that's very difficult to do nowadays.
Yes.
Yeah, it's true. But I do think, though, and I think you said it yourself, the idea of getting beyond yourself, which is one of the reasons that I do think critique groups, or at least having really good, solid beta readers that you trust, is very important, because I do think we need to get out of our own heads insofar as the work we're producing is work we expect other people outside of our heads to appreciate, right? I mean, if we're writing stuff for ourselves, then clearly we could just write stuff for ourselves and whatever. But I do think we need to be able to sort of absorb outside suggestions and things of that kind, assuming they are good quality ones. I totally am with you on that one. But I think we need to be able to do that rather than just sort of staying in our own box, because I think that makes it very difficult then for us to be able to get outside the box when we want the thing published. And I have read stuff that I've thought, you know, this is work that would have been – I get it from my students. This is work which would have been well suited and would have been good stuff, but it clearly needed some, you know, modification, and probably not just from the person's own head. But stuff outside of that too.
Criticism to me is very much a muscle that has to be both for taking and giving, really has to be developed. I always give due diligence to what is being told to me of my work, because I've watched way too many authors argue immediately instead of listening when you're trying to give the critique.
Right, right.
I've watched people tear up their pages in front of me slowly because they brought their best seven pages in and it's polished as polished as they can get. Like, well, did you come here to get a cookie or did you come here to make it awesome? And I'm like,
wait, there's cookies?
It is. There's always cookies. awesome doesn't necessarily always walk into the room. It is a rare bird who shows up with the best book ever for a read and critique session. And to me, I just kind of take it all in and I kind of at least do the mental gymnastics of like, okay, well, what if I did do that? Would it actually serve the story? Would it improve it? And then I'm like, I'll say, well, that's not the story I'm going with, and I'll discard certain things. The one time I fought my editor tooth and nail on the thing is the one thing readers complained about most in the series because I didn't change it. And I'm like, I should have listened.
Yeah. My thing is, if you go to a critique group, if there aren't enough people in that critique group challenging you, it's not the right critique group.
If you're the best critiquer in the group, it's time to leave.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's the rule.
If you like me, I should get out of here.
Let me ask a quick rapid fire question. Patrick mentioned the internal editor. Tell me one or two authors where your internal editor does not turn on. Because I treasure those now. And I'll just mention the one that I've read most recently that doesn't happen with is Scott Lynch. I've been burning my way through Lies of Locke Lamora and then Red Skies Under Over Red Seas and then The Republic of Thieves.
If you're asking me, I'm going to go with Brandon Sanderson, Gail Carriger, and Jim Butcher. Those are the three that I just read it and I absolutely get sucked in and I don't, you know, everything else gets tuned out and turned off. I'm in.
All right. Anton?
For me, I have to go with the ones who I see stuff a little bit, but I don't care at all. With Stephen King, I know he's not a good closer all the time. Like, he'll have a great, creepy, amazing story, but he can't always close the deal at the end of the books. I forgive the hell out of that and turn off the editor. Neil Gaiman, he kind of always, to me, is telling the same stories. They're all bits and pieces of stuff I've kind of read in Sandman or, oh, like, it's, oh, there's the Fury Witches again. Ha, 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 ha. Now they're in a novel. Okay, great. But I still put that aside and love the hell out of it anyway.
You know that Stephen King was very famous not too long ago for complaining because his publisher said, well, you don't need to be edited.
And so there's a refreshing change.
Right. Yeah, and really. So they were just going to publish his book. And he's like, no,
that's insane.
I want an editor. I want an editor now.
But that's why he's been as successful as he has been, because he doesn't assume that every man is an island, right? I mean, because most, as you know, most of it goes the opposite direction. As they get bigger and have less editing, the work theoretically gets worse, or at least could have used more editing all along the way. I think for me, probably, that probably comes down to one of two people. It's either, and it has to do with actually two books of theirs that I read. So it's in particular these two books. I don't know if the authors in general would be that way. Although I agree that Brandon Sanderson is often that way for me. But the two specific ones were, Brad's heard me talk about this a million times. Sorry, Brad, but The Dervish House, Ian McDonald, is to me absolutely blew me away. Completely blew me away. Totally compelling. And oddly enough, I felt like I was also admiring the incredible craftsmanship of it at the same time that I was compelled by it. So that is to say, I was also like, look at the artistry, you know, like on top of everything else. So I love that. And the other one was China Mieville's The City and the City. And that was largely because I had never read Mieville before. So these people are like, oh, Mieville's stuff is so weird. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, you just wrote a straight police procedural. What? You know, like, but The City and the City to me is an incredibly well done book as a book that I was just thoroughly enjoyed from beginning to end and got to the end of it. And I was like, this is the most amazing thing I've ever read. It's incredible. And also great craft, but thoughtful, thematic, smart, intelligent, and also really compelling story writing also. Those were two where the inner editor was definitely not on for either one.
Let me just throw out the short form too. Kiz Johnson, I think, is a master craftsman when it comes to short stories. I almost feel like you were saying, Greg, the craftsman certainly comes out, the artistry in it. And I almost feel like she's toying with me a little bit. She's so good at doing what she does.
Yep. She is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Swanwick is a little like that too.
I have a hard time with short stories. I have a hard time reading them and writing them. And it's funny because I'll tell John DiNardo, I'll say, you know, I just read this story in such and such. What'd you think of it? He's like, oh, that was my favorite in the whole thing. I'm like, oh, never mind.
You're about to launch into a critique. Of,
right, right.
Now, is it so, because you want more from the story? Like you get through it and you're like, this would be great if it were longer? Or what is it that you're not getting from the short story form?
Maybe because when I read, I tend to go and look for number one series. I like to find series, you know, an author who's got more than one book, and I like the big doorstoppers. I really do. I mean, that's kind of where I started when I got back into reading science fiction and fantasy. Is I started reading epic fantasies.
Yep.
Because again, I had that little break in time where I thought, oh gosh, you know, I'm an adult now. I needed to read John Grisham and Tom Clancy. and then I told the story before. I was running through an airport in Atlanta and I needed a book because I'd forgotten my whatever Clancy book I was reading at the time. I forgot a book and I run by this table and I just saw a dragon on a book cover and I grabbed it, paid for it, went and read it. And it ended up being Dennis L. McKiernan's, Dragon Doom or something like that.
Yeah.
And that's right. I used to love this stuff. And when I got back home in Knoxville at the time, I went to the local bookstore and I went into the science fiction fantasy section and I just started buying the biggest, thickest books I could find and just consuming them one after another.
Yeah.
So maybe that is it. I don't know. I had a question for you guys because you've all done interviews. What was the most awkward interview you've ever done? Because I can tell you, the Fingerprints of the Gods guy was not the most awkward. You mentioned Ian McDonald. I actually, when I met him, I was incredibly nervous. It was at Worldcon. And I had set up this interview and he invited me up to his room and we're just sitting there and he's drinking something and we're just chatting. And he tells me that he's going to wear a kilt to the Hugos. And I just became fixated on the fact that, well, when you wear a kilt, you're not supposed to wear underwear. And that ended up being like the narrative for the entire interview. I just kept asking him about the damn kilt to the point where after the Hugos, you know, I meet him and there's the Ink Punks are there and they all went to Clarion with him and we're just chatting and he looks at one of the Ink Punks and he says, you know, Patrick here is obsessed with whether or not I'm wearing underwear. So that's like my awkward interview story. I'm wondering, do you guys have any awkward interviews?
Yes.
Does it have to do with underwear? Because we could all just shut the show down if you like.
No, not as such. Sometimes I worry that my own biases feed too much into it. And I know these are candid conversational things you're having. Like when I was talking with Lev Grossman, we had met at San Diego Comic-Con and we were both huge D&D nerds. But when I was kind of researching him, he was like he and his entire family are all like really Harvard graduates, very erudite, and his books are kind of like erudite Harry Potter hipster modern stuff, which are awesome. But I think I fixated too much on how I went to community college and he went to like Harvard. And not that I had a chip on my shoulder, but I feel like a lot of questioning. He was like, yeah, I wish that wasn't up on my bio that I went there. And I was like, oh no. Now I feel bad even like the class warfare I've suddenly created just asking a couple questions born of my own insecurity, I guess.
So you made the Harvard graduate feel guilty for having gone to Harvard? Like you were again
being
made
a bestseller.
Guilty. Like, how dare I, as a community college graduate, make this guy feel bad about himself?
Lev Grossman left that interview going, damn it, I knew he was a Yale man.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my gosh, that's funny. I know exactly who it is, Brad. I wonder if this is going to be related to one that yours is. It had nothing to do with the interviewee specifically. It had to do with the fact that something was screwed up with the way we were handling, like Skype. And we've done interviews with people in Australia. We interviewed Jonathan Strahan. We've interviewed people all over the place. This particular one, we interviewed, Ross Lockhart.
Yeah.
And, for whatever reason, something about the connection made it so that he was, and Ross is kind of, when he responds to things, he's kind of like, there's a pause, you know, and then he's like, well, let me think about, right? Anyway, so that combined with some strange delay meant that, I kid you not, there was like 10 second gaps you could drive a Mack truck through. So you'd be like, and there was a point where I was trying to anticipate. I'm like, did he get shot in the interim? Like, what exactly happened? And it was, I have to tell you, at the time I was doing audio editing, thank goodness for our Patreon, I no longer have to do the audio editing. That was the most painful, tedious. I seriously, at one point in the middle of it, I shut it off. I'm like, I'm wondering if I should drop Brad an email saying, Brad, it's been real. I am never doing this again. Like, it was horrible. And it was awkward doing it because it was just like, so what about this? Pause.
Yeah.
Pause.
Really fun to pause. Edit that one too, wasn't it?
Oh God. And I'm like furiously typing back and forth to Brad. What happened? Did he fall off his chair? Like, what is going on? Oh God almighty.
I used to have a microphone that, had a bad, piece of software associated with it. Essentially the audio codecs. And what would happen is about 60 minutes into anything, I would start to Cylon.
How fun.
And so we would always have to pause and wait for like a minute, minute and a half for it to go away, and then we could continue recording.
Interesting.
It was a pain.
Oh, yeah. We had that too, Greg.
The one hour thing for you. You go to an hour, and all of a sudden you get.
Yeah. It's the audio. It's the audio file. It's the firmware or the software that actually runs the microphone.
Well, now you tell me, Patrick. Damn it. In terms of mine, I would say, Greg, when we first started, I won't say that we were on the same level as everybody we interviewed, but I felt like we were kind of in the same ballpark, or, they were, very high up there, and they were just very congenial, very easy interviewees.
Right.
But when we got to James Patrick Kelly and Michael Swanwick, we had these two masters on the show, and it was the first time I think that I really felt like, wow, like what am I doing here talking to these guys? Yeah. It was just so a little awkward just on my side. It wasn't an awkward interview, I don't think, but inside I just kept thinking, and Greg mentioned like a master class early on, and I felt like that too, like I was, just kind of soaking up everything I said too.
Jim's a really nice guy who I'd interviewed previously, but I know what you mean, because it's also sort of like a master class where you wonder if they're glaring at you, like really, that's that question, right. You know what I mean? Like, and then the thing
face
is like,
of the eyebrow.
Right, and you worry, because we're also, writers in this field, you're worried like, oh my God, did I piss them off? Like if somebody asks them for a blurb 10 years from now, are they going to be like, that fool, he once asked me if I have any underwear? You know what I mean? Like I had this image that everything was sort of relying on the nature of the question. The truth is that we've been very lucky, and I actually am curious if you guys have found this too. I don't know that we've ever had a guest that there have been one or two guests I can think of who were maybe a little more prickly than I would have liked. And I feel like, not even to me, but I felt like we're sort of, I don't know, I would have appreciated, I don't know whether their mindset was quite right for the interview, but it was fairly mild, and it was not something that anyone outside the show would have noticed. But these sort of disasters you sometimes hear on sports shows, I remember listening to a podcast where they interviewed Reggie Jackson, who just essentially more or less told the interviewer that he had never heard such moronic questions. It was painfully awkward. That's partly because it's Reggie Jackson who, but I'm curious, have you guys ever had a situation where you felt, I feel like our guests have been pretty good people. I mean, maybe we're just good at picking them, but I feel like they're good people that don't make it clear that they're frustrated if they ever have been, like they seem to be enjoying the conversations. Have you guys had ones where you're like, oh, okay, I shouldn't have done that interview? I mean,
well, speaking of sports shows, as you were a second ago, one of my favorite books actually came out through Penguin the other year. This is not a plug, as such. My opinions are expressly those of my own and do not represent Penguin Random House or any of its subsidiaries or affiliates.
Have we told you about Anton's sponsor, Penguin?
Yeah.
No, Angry Robot.
Yeah.
There was a book called The Postmortal by Drew McGarry, and it was kind of the cure for aging happens. And so people don't die anymore. And, it's a trope out there in genre, but it was a great semi-literary book, and Drew McGarry is known as a sports writer for Deadspin. And I was like, I could not get my mind wrapped around how this sports writing, like smack-talking, quirky guy wrote this little book, and that was like my favorite book of the year. So I had him on, he dialed in, and he's a sports guy. And so I felt like he was very much like, he doesn't know me, he doesn't necessarily know genre, as such, he's not like really heavy on genre. He just happened to write this amazing book as not a huge genre participant. And I felt like he was so out of his element. He doesn't know my world. I don't know his world. And a lot of good came out of the conversation, but I felt like for a good half hour, we were both like eyeing each other, like sports nerds in the hall, sports and nerds eyeing each other in the hallway.
Right. All of a sudden it's the Sharks and the Jets doing like a snap off in the hall.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, I actually, I do remember this was not even on this show. We did an interview on the comedy show that I mentioned, but the guy, David Reese, who wrote, the comic strip, Get Your War On, who's a really strange guy. Like later on, we found out that he was a strange guy. We didn't know it at the time. And we were interviewing him via TeamSpeak. This is before we were using things like PowerGramo and Skype and stuff like that. And he was just, well, he was a jerk. I can say that now because now he's become a woodworker and he's left comics behind and whatever else. But he was really a jerk about it. And so what was funny was he had no idea. He clearly never listened to the show. It was very obvious that he had no idea that the show was a comedy show run by three debaters who are used to people being jerks to them, you know, so we were not going to be disrupted by it. But it was a funny experience because it, you know, at the end of it, it just sort of, it confirmed that that was silly to bring him on, but it was very funny, partially because of his jerkiness in a way, that it sort of came out that way. And so I guess it's just lucky that we have not run into that because people are generally nice people in this field, I guess, you know, that not to that same level. Cause even what you're talking about, Anton, was just, that was about sort of a meeting of the minds. That wasn't sort of outright hostility, you know, right. Like someone saying, what is this silly fantasy stuff? You know? So yeah.
Well, I had a great kind of experience early on with the awkwardness with the Amazon dude. And when we first started this whole thing, John and Elio and I, we decided that there were three rules that we were always going to live by in podcasting. And we have those three rules, and we always tell whoever's coming on the show our three rules. And we tell them before we start recording. And there's a couple different reasons that we do that. One is because we genuinely don't want to talk about these things. And number two, it's kind of amusing and it makes people laugh, but it also sets them, it sets like a tone for them. So I'll tell people, we have three rules of podcasting. These are three things that we're not going to talk about on this podcast today. I want to go through them with you. Are you okay with that? And they'll go, yeah, sure. And I'll say, number one, we're not going to talk about politics. And they go, oh, okay, yeah, you know what, that's good, yeah, I really don't want to talk about politics. I'm like, okay, good, we're not going to talk about religion. And they go, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, that's good, yeah, I don't want to talk about religion. I said, okay, and we're not going to talk about barbecue. And then they immediately start laughing. And they say, barbecue? And I said, yeah, because these are the three most polarizing topics in this country, and Yankees always get barbecue wrong. And then they laugh some more, and now they're
now wait a second,
right? And they feel a little bit better. But yeah. But here's the thing: on Functional Nerds, we had an episode where I said this to this guy, and he's like, okay, great. And as soon as we introduced him, he went into his personal politics and the PAC that he was a part of, and the ads that he ran against such and such presidential candidate, and he did this and this and this and this, and he specifically went down that road.
I was just gonna say, he's right. Like, and while I'm talking to someone over the barbecue coal,
right? It was completely awkward, and Anilio and I were going, wow, you know, I can't believe this. And it ended up being one of our lowest downloaded shows.
Yeah.
And it's because what happens is when you talk about those things, you alienate 50% of your listeners.
I said I was sorry.
Least.
Okay.
It wasn't you.
But
that tends to happen. And that's the other reason that we did it, is because when you talk about those things, it doesn't really win you any fans. All it does is make someone out there go, oh, well, you know what? If that's what they think, then I don't want to read their book.
But, you know, I think one of the ways to avoid that, and I think this is something which we've been able to pick up over time, so much of this comes from the sort of general tone and impression that's set by us, the podcaster, and maybe this is something for folks listening who are thinking about trying it. So much is based on how you set things up to begin with. So when you make it clear that there's things that will sort of fit into the scope of the show and things that won't, it makes that a lot easier. I mean, I should say that I have experienced some cases where people were able to talk about the political or real world implications of what they were writing, and it was very powerful. Again, the Lauren Bucus example that I made before. But the difference was, I think you're absolutely right that what you're talking about there is a guy who just went completely off the rails. And so that stands out in your mind because it so rarely happens, because you sort of lay down the way that the ground rules. And I think that generally works really well when you sort of establish from the very beginning, this is the way things are. And I find that, you know, at a certain point also, it helps that once your show is out there for long enough, people sort of understand the deal. You know, we no longer, when we have people, because we have a lot of people now that actually ask to be on the show. And when we talk to people about getting on the show, some of them maybe not have heard, not everyone has heard of it, but a number of people have. And for those who haven't, they immediately can Google it and about 3 seconds later get a sense of what the show's about. And that's really, really helpful, I think. It's something that as you do more shows, you sort of have a certain, you know, sort of space that you occupy that people are aware of. And so it becomes easier to do that. And I think that tone that you set from the very beginning is helpful for both listeners, and it's helpful for the guests who were on the show going forward. So in a way, that's a problem that hopefully lessens over time, you know, as you're establishing
it. It also makes it so a lot of people are nervous when they come on.
Yeah.
And what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to set them at ease, and I'm letting them know, I'm not going to ask you a gotcha question. I'm not that guy. I'm not going to pinion the corner. I don't want to do that. What I want to do, I want to learn about you as the author. I want to learn about your stories, your books, whatever it is that you're pushing out there right now, because I want people to get as excited about your work as you are.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you do that, it makes everything about the show, about them, and also about what you're learning from it better. You know, everybody wins.
Yes.
In that scenario. Well, we should probably wrap this up, guys. And I guess we should wrap it up by just saying what's up next for us individually. And also, where can people, what's the site to get, to download the show? So Anton, what about you? What have you got up next? Which one of your 700 sponsors will be sponsoring it, and, where can they find it?
Well, we've got a game company sponsoring this episode.
Nice.
Which, of course, I'm not looking at my sheet of our vast amount of sponsors, you know.
Who's the game company?
I don't even know what I'm going to do with all these sponsors. It's actually, I believe it's Mage, which is doing a fantastic Kickstarter right now.
Yeah.
And they've got some games that we're going to be giving away as well, in the process. But enough about that for now. they'll hear about that in the mid-show ad on here, and then they can write angry emails about how they don't want ads in their content, which I'll ignore. They can find the show at the onceandfuturepodcast.com or at the Once and Future Podcast Facebook page. All the episodes are up there. There's about 60 or so far. For myself, I've got a new Simon Kandris story that I'm finishing up for the Fierce Anthology, which is a Jim Butcher and Kerry Hughes edited, coming out from Ace next year. I'm tying up the end of a Dickensian Iron Man Voltron steampunk street urchin thing, for kids.
What, no writing horror?
Yeah, he's got that market cornered.
Horror? And I've got one other pitch going on and a secret project, which I can't talk about with another author. I'm not helpful with that. Sorry.
Nice vague booking on the podcast.
I shall vague book.
Vague casting.
What about you, Patrick?
Well, the SF Signal podcast can be found at sfsignal.com, and that is obviously the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com. We are there usually at least once a week right now. Basically, life has interfered with me. I used to do two a week, but we are creeping up on 300 episodes. Fairly soon, probably. Who knows? But between that and functionalnerds.com, I'm probably over 500 episodes at this point of podcasts. So I've done a lot of podcasting in the past few years. My personal website is ATFMB, which stands for All Things From My Brain. And that's my blog. That's where you can find links to all of my fiction that's out there. I'm in a couple of anthologies. I've got some ebooks out, so on and so forth. Unfortunately, that urban fantasy did not sell. So I'm probably going to move on and do something else at this point.
Oh, okay.
As for me, Greg and I were doing a triptych on Lev Grossman's The Magicians, and we're going to have Lev on with a triptych of shows. And we tried to get Lev on.
Harvard. Don't talk about Harvard.
What is your opinion on community
Take
college
note,
people?
Yeah.
just keep talking about Yale.
Yeah, well, about
what
Yale?
A great school Yale.
Maybe
is.
It was Yale. I don't remember now.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to having him on because we're going to have him on last year and then just things just didn't work out.
Keep calling him Blake.
Calling him Blake?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we'll do.
Doesn't he look like Blake Charlton?
And as for me and my writing, you can find me at quillings.com. My life is boiling down to the edits for 12 Kings and Sharkai, which comes out next year. And I'll put out a quick plug. I'm starting a Kickstarter December 1st through December 30th, and it's called 6x6. And it's a group of six authors with six stories each, so 36 stories in all. So it's kind of an anthology in a way, but we're offering it one time in the Kickstarter, after which it will not be offered in that form again. And so it's me, Tina Connolly, Will McIntosh, Steve Gaskell, Brenda Cooper, and Martha Wells. So keep an eye out for that starting December 1st.
Yeah, they were they were plotting that on World Fantasy. That I was just at with him. So they were like doing their plotting thing. As for me, I am at the moment not only in the process of writing my fourth novel, and I have a short story that's going to be released in an anthology next year that I'm working on, but also getting ready and some other projects, but also getting ready for the release of Icarus in a couple of months from Silence in the Library Publishing, the graphic novel. So that's an interesting process of also trying to work with the artist too, and not just on the text on the page things. That's been interesting. But that information can always be found at my website, which is gregoryawilson.com. And obviously there's a link to that at our show, which is speculatesf.com as well. This has been fun, guys. I enjoyed it. It's good times.
We should probably do this again for people.
Absolutely. Next week.
Yeah, because it's so easy scheduling our time.
All the work that went into getting this going.
This was a first shot. We just decided to do it, and an hour later it just happened. It's totally
it's magic.
Totally what occurred. Well, thanks everybody from us at Speculate, and thank you guys. Anton, Patrick, thanks guys. It was fun.
Thank you.
Yes, it was. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast. Your host is Patrick Hester, an author, a blogger, and a functional nerd. His website is www.atfmb.com, which stands for All Things From My Brain. ATFMB is also his Twitter handle and where you can find him on Facebook. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the links to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com or search SF Signal in iTunes. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and have them tell their friends and so on and so on. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all of your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal regulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melds featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SF&F field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, fiction deals, movie reviews, videos, links and roundup posts, and more. Click the RSS button in the sidebar of your browser to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo?
Angry robot.
Magic wooey.
Wah, wah.
Thinking and crap.
And scene.